This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, diplomacy over Damascus.
In part because of the credible threat of U.S. military action, as well as constructive talks that I had with President Putin, the Russian government has indicated a willingness to join with the international community in pushing Assad to give up his chemical weapons.
President Obama yesterday speaking to the nation, even as the fighting continued in Syria, as diplomacy seemed to offer an option on the issue of chemical weapons. The United Nations reminded us yesterday that the civil war has destroyed a third of Syria's housing stock and made 4.25 million people essentially homeless. This hour, a look at the origins of the new diplomacy on Syria, also the challenge of trying to control rather than deter the use of chemical weapons in Syria, and the unabated escalation of the refugee crisis. We'll also discuss the milestones of 12 years after September 11th, the rebuilding taking place in Lower Manhattan, and the approaching milestone of 10 billion people on planet Earth. All that this hour. But first, can diplomacy and good old-fashioned arms control change the crisis in Syria?
It's too early to tell whether this offer will succeed. And any agreement must verify that the Assad regime keeps its commitments. But this initiative has the potential to remove the threat of chemical weapons without the use of force, particularly because Russia is one of Assad's strongest allies.
Suddenly, the U.S. and Russia are possibly engaged in a diplomatic initiative to acquire and control, rather than simply strike and deter, the use of Syria's chemical weapons. We turn now to Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus and Board Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Les, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
So what do you make of this? Arms control here? Is that what's going on? Or have the Russians and the Americans kind of backed into something?
I think they totally backed into something, or at least the Americans backed into it. The Russians, I think, were surprised to have this arms control opportunity laid at their laps.
And the way this was laid in their laps came from a statement from Secretary of State John Kerry. Let's play that clip at a news conference with British Foreign Secretary William Hague in London just a few days ago.
He could turn over every single bit of his chemical weapons to the international community in the next week. Turn it over, all of it, without delay, and allow a full and total accounting for that. But he isn't about to do it.
Now, Les Gelb, do you hear Secretary of State Kerry improvising there and the Russians taking advantage of it, or is that a trial balloon?
I don't think there's any doubt he was senatorially improvising, because very shortly after he made that statement, the State Department issued a statement saying, well, you have to understand that was only rhetoric. In other words, don't pay any attention to it. He had just been talking off the top of his head. But the Russians certainly didn't see it that way. They saw it as an opportunity. So these people were ready to pounce, and we weren't ready to propose.
Well, what do you make of the theory, and the president even referred to this in his speech last night, that the threat of military action is really the incentive driving the Russians? And I'm wondering if this is a life raft offered by the Russians to the Americans to get President Obama out of a diplomatic crisis here, or if this is really the Russians trying to improve relations with the U.S.
Well, I don't think the Russians are known for offering life rafts to anyone, especially to the United States. I think they were pursuing their own interest here. And the first interest, the primary interest for them, was to prevent an American strike on Syria. Syria is the Middle Eastern ally for Moscow. And if the United States struck and the Russians had no real military response, and they did not, then, you know, they were the ones who were going to look weak. So they were trying to head it off. And they're heading it off with a proposal that I think all experts in this business think is a long shot to make it work.
Well, we'll talk about the technical details of that long shot in a moment. But in terms of the Russian chess game here, this really raises the profile of the Russians and puts them in a leadership position in heading off this crisis. It seems to me it's more about raising Russian profile than it is preventing some Tomahawk missiles going off, yes?
No. I think it's more about preventing the missiles from going off against Syria. The Russians could have made a proposal like this on their own last week or last month. They didn't. I think they probably thought about it as quickly as Secretary Kerry laid it on the table.
So they're both backing into this, and Kerry's improvisation has really produced an interesting kind of a jazz ensemble in terms of diplomacy all of a sudden.
That's right. See, it's actually very unusual, John, as you know, for a former senator to become a Secretary of State. We just had one with Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton was not the voluble kind of former senator given to vast oratory. Senator Kerry, when he was a senator, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, he just got used to saying whatever came to his mind.
So do you think the upshot of this is the administration says to Kerry, clear every remark with us from now on, or thanks a lot for thinking out of the box, dude?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly what the relationship is between President Obama and Secretary Kerry, whether he called him in and scolded him, but I would guess that that State Department rebuke to the secretary that this was only rhetoric was checked out with the White House.
Indeed.
And that initially they weren't terribly happy.
Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus and Board Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much, as always.
Pleasure, John.
So whether they backed into it or not, arms control and diplomacy is where President Obama is headed now in his chilly partnership with the Russians.
We will work together in consultation with Russia and China to put forward a resolution at the UN Security Council requiring Assad to give up his chemical weapons and to ultimately destroy them under international control.
So how hard of a task is this, assuming an agreement can even be reached? International monitors of chemical weapons estimate that Syria has at least 1,000 tons of chemical agents under its control. Ambassador Richard Butler joins us now. He ran the UN Weapons Inspection Organization in Iraq, UNSCOM, in the late 1990s. He's currently a distinguished scholar of international peace and security at Penn State's School of International Affairs. Ambassador Butler, how difficult will this task be of getting rid of Syria's chemical weapons?
I was fascinated by what my old friend and mentor, Liz Gelb, was saying a minute ago. And I have to weigh in quickly on one point, and it does lead to how difficult or easy will the task be. The question of who benefited from this proposal. Did it get Obama off the hook or did it get the Russians off the hook? Maybe it has, in some measure, helped President Obama. Having heard his speech last night, I strongly doubt that. But the people who got themselves off a hook immediately were the Russians. They seized an opportunity to stop those missiles raining down on their ally, and that was of incredible importance to them. Now, the question, John, is have they put themselves on a hook with this proposal that Syria says it's agreed to reveal all of its chemical weapons, have that verified, and have them all destroyed?
Well, technically, are the Russians on the hook? Is that difficult? Can they not verify that sort of thing? Are chemical agents much more difficult to detect?
Of course it can be verified if an accurate declaration of the stocks, the holdings, is made. One of the hooks the Russians have put themselves on is that as this work proceeds, it will be revealed to the world that a very substantial portion of Syrian chemical weapons capability very likely has Russian origins. Oh, and to draw a wonderful little Iraq connection, and many people are saying, is this just a rerun of 10 years ago and the bogus invasion of Iraq? Let me say that when I wound up my work as head of the special UN Special Commission to Disarm Iraq and did report to the Security Council that we had elementally succeeded, I said there were a few unaccounted for chemical munitions. We strongly suspected, John, that why we didn't find them was that Iraq had moved them across the border to Syria to get them out of our reach and given them to the Syrians.
What process should we watch for? You said something about an accurate declaration going in, and then the Russians, you know, have a lot of cards to play here, and then the international community has a lot of sort of bars to be met so that we can understand that this actually has taken place.
Okay. Here's the deal as I see it from that deep experience with the Special Commission in Iraq. Any sensible plan to get this job done would take the following form. One, Syria must be obliged to accurately and honestly declare all of its holdings of CW. and that involves their manufacture, their storage, their holdings in weaponized form and so on, absolutely everything that they've got. Two, UN inspectors, international inspectors, must be given total access to verify the accuracy of that declaration. That's access to facilities, to materials, and to talk to people, people who were involved in making those substances. Three, they will then have to be put in a location, assembled together, corralled, if you like, in a location that is secure, where four, they can be destroyed. The first thing to watch for, John, is whether or not the Russians, having made this proposal, and the Syrians having said they agree to it, are prepared to accept a regime which has those four characteristics. Anything less than that will be empty and will not work.
And what's the likelihood? Your colleague Les Gelb said this is a real long shot.
I think it's a long shot. I think when the Russians and the Syrians are confronted with this, they're not going to like it and they'll want to stall, which is why they're talking about take the military option off the table. That is a complete red herring. Will they do it? I'm not absolutely sure. But at least for the time being, let's be grateful for this. Let's try and end on a positive note.
Well, we're grateful for it and grateful for your insights. We certainly have a lot to watch here. Ambassador Richard Butler ran the UN Weapons Inspection Organization in Iraq in the late 1990s, chairman of UNSCOM. Ambassador, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Who can't say goodbye to AM radio? Lots of you responded to our discussion of how AM is facing interference from digital devices and obsolescence as a medium. You say, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, my name's Tim. I'm from Vancouver, Washington. And my fondest memory of AM radio was Sunday nights going home from Grandma's house listening to Suspense Radio Theater.
Come in. Welcome. Sit back and lend us your fears.
There was nothing like growing up way up in the tip of Leelanau County in Michigan in the lower peninsulas, and at 1 o'clock in the morning getting the great tunes and sounds of WLS from right downtown Chicago. WLS in Chicago. It was like the whole world had just appeared in your little farm boy bedroom.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Coming up on this 12th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we're remembering the towers that once stood and paying tribute to what's emerging in its place.
You know, it's not very often that you get to have a second chance.
Architect David Childs on the building of One World Trade Center. He's with us next. So exactly 12 years ago, Mr. David Childs, you know where you were, yes?
I sure do. That's right. Looking out my window and seeing the devastation of that horrible morning. It was a beautiful day. Thank goodness we had absolutely no wind. It was a little cooler than today, but it was still beautiful, and those buildings fell straight down rather than tipping over.
Architect David Childs is one of the most famous in the world, principal partner at the legendary Owing Skidmore and Merrill. He's known for his role in the center of urban politics and controversy as much as for his buildings and designs. You could see the scars of battle on his tough but deeply lined face as he visited our studios earlier today. It is his name on the One World Trade Center building now dominating the skyline in Lower Manhattan. Childs is also the central character in a Nova documentary produced by our partner WGBH, which explores the struggle behind the construction of the multi-billion dollar building. Ground Zero Super Tower airs on PBS tonight. It tells the story of how architect Childs was given the chance to both honor a moment in time and a historic place in New York City.
More than an opportunity, it's a responsibility to appropriately mark this extraordinary event that changed the world, not just New York. And what's amazing to me is that actually has been done so quickly. People don't realize the complexity of construction down there. We're building in the river, literally, because Manhattan had expanded from the original shorelines, but the river still runs right underneath there. And so to build all the way to bedrock and then have 80 feet before you get to grade of the most complicated security, mechanical systems and all of that, then plus all these buildings on top, it's really been a remarkable thing done by many, many people.
I remember speaking to you 12 years ago and just how emotional you got describing how because of decisions in architecture, a lot of people were saved on that day and a lot of people couldn't be saved. And yeah. I could see in your mind almost the blueprints that condemned so many to death but also that saved so many. Does this building, this new building, make a statement to try to correct that, to try to save those people that couldn't have been saved?
Yes. In fact, there are many, many things that this building has to do. And one of them is to be innovative about safety and how buildings operate, as well as being green and all those things. But America invented the skyscraper. But we had fallen behind. I do work around the world of tall buildings, and actually the inventions had crept up abroad. What we were able to do here was not only to bring us up to international standards, but to surpass them with a full concrete core, very, very stiff in the center, especially wide stairs and so forth, and then redundant steel on the outside to make this a remarkably safe building. I think this is the safest building you can imagine.
Nova calls this Ground Zero Super Tower. Is it a super tower or is it simply an architectural response to a tragic event, a building like many others in this city?
Well, you know, you have high-rise buildings, which was a generic word, and then you have tall buildings, as they're often referred to in my world. And that's because they are super tall. They have a very thin aspect of ratio of a very small footprint and being very, very tall. So they're very unique in that way. And in the sense it is. It's also a skyscraper, which has a much more romantic character to it because it really is an iconic marker of the memorial. It's one of the major roles that it plays. The most important event down there, architecturally speaking, really is the memorial to remember this thing. But it has no marker. If you're traveling 42nd Street or coming in from the New Jersey Turnpike, you don't know where it is. You just know downtown. Mm-hmm. Now it has a marker there. You know exactly where that memorial is. And in its simplicity, I think people will remember its shape and like the Washington Monument in a way and have a sense of its uniqueness. So in many of these ways, the super tower is the appropriate word, I think.
Given your life connection to that lower Manhattan area and to the city at large, is there an irony in the fact that this site will always be a series of buildings surrounding a memorial that essentially misses the presence of two destroyed buildings? That's an architectural statement like no other.
Well, you know, there were many different thoughts originally. There was a big component of the public who wanted nothing down here, this whole acreage, enormous amount of acreage, nothing to be built. And that would have been a big, big mistake, I thought. But to be able to preserve an important sized park is not only a proper fitting setting for the memorial, but it is a wonderful setting for all the buildings around it. It's like the New York Public Library Park. It gives meaning and reference to the buildings surrounding it in a way that it never had before.
So it's the park that the original World Trade Center never had.
Exactly right. And it's green and it's open. And this area will be a place for memory. But it would also be a place for enjoyment, walking in the sunlight with the dappled shade from all the new trees and benches to sit on. It's going to be a wonderful space for New Yorkers.
I've got to ask you this. When you see pictures of the old Twin Towers, how do you feel?
Well, you know, I feel many things. Of course, it immediately brings to me my mind, first of all, is the tragedy that had in those horrible hours that buildings fell. But on the second hand, I thought, you know, it's not very often that you get to have a second chance. And when that development happened. It was by a very good architect, but it was at a bad time for architecture. It was built without spaces for people. It was a raised platform that was cold in the winter. It really was one of the most forbidding spaces that had no relationship to the rest of the city. So what's now there is a piece of New York. The streets go through. They come to grade. It's a different place, certainly, than it was a dozen years ago.
Well, David Childs, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
David Childs is the architect with Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, designed the One World Trade Center. Childs is featured in a Nova documentary produced by our partner WGBH that airs on PBS tonight. The film is called Ground Zero Supertower. And now an update on a situation in Syria not likely to be resolved by the latest diplomacy we've been discussing, the escalating refugee crisis. We are joined by Andrew Harper, head of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees operation in Jordan, which is at the epicenter of the refugee crisis. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Nothing really being talked about in Washington is going to affect the refugee count you're seeing exploding really throughout the region.
Well, that's correct. Last week, we hit the 2 million mark in the region. On top of that, we've got over 4 million people displaced inside Syria. So whatever happens is not really going to affect that. What we are sure of is that the numbers of displaced, both inside Syria and those fleeing to the surrounding countries, is going to increase.
Now, many people describe the refugee outflux from Syria as one of the main vectors spreading instability throughout the region. We saw in Iraq the refugee situation helping to destabilize Syria. Now it appears the Syrian refugee situation is helping to destabilize Lebanon, Jordan, and possibly even Iraq again. What are you seeing?
Well, it's a pretty tough neighborhood to begin with. Like if you look at Jordan's neighbors, we've got Iraq, we've got Syria, we've got Palestine, Israel, Saudi Arabia. It's a pretty rough neighborhood to begin with. And the fact that Jordan has been able to maintain its stability throughout this crisis as well as the Iraq crisis is a testament of probably the leadership here. But it's also a testament of where investment, particularly from the West, and I must add the US is one of the biggest supporters to Jordan, is paying dividends. But for some of the other countries in the region, like Lebanon, there's no doubt that having to cope with an additional 500,000 people is putting an enormous strain on its stability. And that strain is also taking place in Jordan, particularly on the access to services, access to water, children having to double up on lessons, access to hospital beds. There's nowhere in Jordan at the moment which is not being affected by the Syrian crisis. Many of the institutions 2 years ago were already struggling, and now they're at breaking point.
Andrew Harper, is this a lost generation in Syria with the level to which the refugee crisis has really affected children?
Well, we saw that happen in Iraq when kids didn't go to school for 4 or 5 years. We're now in a situation in Syria where many schools have been closed for 2 years. And if kids have not been able to go to school for 2 years, it's very difficult to get them back on board. And we're already seeing quite a low attendance rate in the schools in Jordan for the Syrian refugees. So unless this is resolved relatively quickly, or unless there is a significant amount of money put into the education systems in the surrounding countries that are accepting Syrian refugees, then we are looking at a lost generation. And it's not just a lost generation. It's what happens to that generation. If these children grow up with a lack of hope, with a lack of sense of responsibility, then they can be brought into looking at groups which offer them alternatives.
Does the UN believe that Jordan can maintain its sort of position in the political center in this tough neighborhood, as you describe it, indefinitely, or is there pressure on Jordan and they can't sustain this?
Well, there's no doubt there's enormous pressure on Jordan at the moment, and the government is seeing that. And this is why it is so important for organizations like UNHCR and donors to be working very close with the government of Jordan to understand what the priorities are for the country and for the people, because it's imperative that we keep Jordan as stable as possible during this politically security explosive time throughout the region.
Andrew Harper, head of the UNHCR in Jordan, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much for your interest.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. We're going to take our discussion this week of gender issues in the workplace to glimpse a pretty unusual perspective in the university classroom. Jennifer Finney Boylan is entering her 25th year as a professor at Colby College in Maine. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
And you're a professor of English, is that right?
I am indeed.
Now, the first 12 years, you taught not as a woman, but as a man, right?
That's correct. I was James Boylan back in the day, as we call it, and have been Jennifer for the last 13 years.
So you have a window on a statistic that actually crossed our desk as we were investigating these sort of gender in the workplace issues. A recent study suggests that boys tend to fare better in classes taught by men. Girls tend to thrive in classes taught by women. You've been able to see that firsthand through a single pair of eyes. How interesting has this transition been for you?
Yeah, I know. Sometimes I think I'm the experiment and the control, both at once. What's interesting for me is that I know that students react to me differently now than they used to. But is that the difference between a male teacher and a female teacher, or is that the difference between a younger teacher and an older one? It's not entirely clear to me, but I do know that certainly as a teacher, I behave differently in the classroom now. That's for sure.
So, well, you behave differently, certainly. And the students, of course, don't necessarily know, except for the few students who were there during your transition. They don't know that you were ever a different gender. So I'm just wondering, from your own objective position as an amateur social scientist, did the male students perform better or identify with you more in your first 12 years, and the women maybe identify with you more in these second dozen years that you've been teaching?
Well, I'm not certain. I do try to reach everybody. I do know that what's changed is that when I was a male teacher, students would write down my words with great intensity, with a great fury. And since I became female, they're much less likely to take all those notes, and they're more likely now to participate in class discussions. And I guess I have mixed feelings about that because, of course, I like the idea that students might feel more comfortable with me now in the classroom, but there is a large part of me that would still like to be an authority figure as well.
That's so fascinating. So it's hard to be an intimidating hard ass, if you'll excuse the expression, but it's easier to be an engaging kind of mentor.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm also, I think, maybe a little bit less goofy in the classroom than when I was a guy. I was goofy, but I was also I could be a little intimidating. Whereas I think now I'm not quite so. I might not be quite as funny as I used to be because I think I take the world a little more seriously now, having gone from a world of male privilege on the one hand to, as a transgender woman, a member of one of the most marginalized groups in the country.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment before we go. How has it affected your position in the faculty? Is being a woman the key, or being transgender the key to feeling more on the fringe rather than in a privileged class?
I don't feel on the fringe at Colby at all. Colby's been a wonderful, welcoming place for me. But I do know that it is different, that's for sure.
And your fringe situation, is that a situation
that's
of discrimination?
That's as a member of the American culture, where to be a woman is difficult enough, to be trans is even harder.
Well, it's a very, what's on the reading list this semester before we go?
We are reading great American short stories, and I'm trying to get my student to write a few.
All right. Jennifer Finney Boylan's professor of English at Colby College, also a contributing writer for The New York Times. Thanks so much for letting us peer through your eyes as two different people over the last two dozen years. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So here's a question. You got a Hollywood actor you're obsessed with?
A lot of people, you can sort of see them. They're not really listening. They're not within the thing, in between the lines. And you can see them start thinking about their next line. Just a subtle little thing. Not Harry. You watch him in between the lines. He is there. Whatever there needs to be, he's there.
That's director David Lynch talking about the brilliance of an actor named Harry. And here's a singer named Harry, Debbie Harry of Blondie, obsessed with that same actor, who she calls Harry Dean.
I wanna dance with Harry Dean, drive through Texas in a black limousine.
It was about me in Paris, Texas, and I didn't realize at the time what a great accolade he was giving me.
He found out about the song, or somebody told him about it. And then, so we had, of course, then to meet.
Those are clips from the new documentary film Harry Dean Stanton, Partly Fiction, a journey through one of the most illustrious film careers of a living actor in our time. The film opens in theaters in New York today and in select cities on September 27th. The film's director is Sophie Huber. Both Huber and the star of this doc, veteran actor of more than 180 films, Harry Dean Stanton, join us in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
I didn't know I shared my obsession with Harry Dean Stanton with Debbie Harry and David Lynch. I'm thrilled to learn that, Harry Dean Stanton.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful.
Let's talk just for a moment about your perspective as a Hollywood actor. You've worked with Scorsese, Arthur Penn, Wim Wenders, Robert Altman, John Hughes.
Alfred Hitchcock.
John Huston, Frank Darabont. I mean, as well as Jack Nicholson and all of the major actors of your generation.
Yeah.
What kind of a window does that give you on the world of American culture and just filmmaking?
It's the big picture. I see the big picture.
And you know, it's if we're talking about Paris, Texas, which the clip from that film was in the – it was the music that came into this segment. I mean, you're really you've really played a character that everyone can recognize in American films.
Yeah, I play myself.
Is that what attracted you to this project, Sophie?
Yeah, that was one part, but also the music. I think Harry Dean is an incredible singer, and he hasn't recorded many songs except for from a few soundtrack albums that he was on. And that was the beginning of it all, really.
How long have you been a musician?
Since I was 6 years old, I started singing at home. When the family would leave the house, I would get up on a stool and sing. Then I sang in high school glee clubs and college and the Navy glee club. And then I sang in with bands. I've had my own band, and I've been singing all along.
Were you surprised to become an actor and not a singer? As a performer?
Surprised? No. I did a play in college. I knew that's what I wanted to do. But I've managed to do both of them. And so I haven't pursued the music as much as I could have. I've avoided the mainstream and to my own detriment, as success-wise, anyway.
Have you deliberately? Well, I mean, everyone can recognize you. I mean, that's a mark of success. But I guess you would have a different net worth than Jack Nicholson, who you've worked with. But have you avoided success deliberately? No.
I'm in the Eastern line of thought. I have nothing to do with it. Everything evolves the way it evolves. It's just what is at the moment.
So a kind of Hollywood Buddhism with a little bit of country music in there as well.
Yeah, all of the above, yeah.
How hard was it to get people to talk about Harry Dean Stanton for this film?
Well, it was hard to get Harry Dean Stanton talking about himself.
Yeah, I know we're having that trouble ourselves right here today. But, but I think that's one of the that's what we love.
We're having trouble.
No. You're kind of a Yoda character, you know. Oh, wise Harry Dean, tell us how we should go.
Oh, Harry Dean, that's what Bob De Niro calls me.
Really? Oh, Harry Dean. So continue.
Yeah. So it wasn't hard really to get the other people to talk about him. In fact, David Lynch and Debbie Harry and even Sam Shepard, they agreed before Harry Dean agreed to do the documentary.
Is that right?
So it sort of helped to, you know, get him a little more enthused.
What do you think his career and this film says about America, about success, about celebrity, about so many things that really are posed in this, but not definitively answered in any way. What do you think?
Well, I think that will be up to the people who see the film. It's hard for me to say that. For me, it's I kind of like that because I had to find a way to portray somebody who doesn't want to be portrayed in a sort of a way that's more inside his head than explaining him from the outside.
And in a sense, are you doing the Paris, Texas documentary of Harry Dean Stanton in the way that Wim Wenders used your face and your soft-spokenness to portray an amazing place so long ago?
Well, somebody said it is like a sequel to Paris, Texas.
Really?
Which is, you know, that's a nice thing to hear, of course.
So what are you doing next? Sequel to, you know, Alien 6, Harry Dean?
I haven't a clue at this moment.
Do you pick your projects? Do they just come to you?
Whatever comes up, I look at it. If I like it and resonate with it, I do it.
You think you'll do another documentary?
No, I have no clue.
Not about yourself, anyway.
No, it is all written.
De Niro calls you Harry Dean.
Oh, Harry Dean.
Oh, Harry Dean. What's Nicholson call you?
Snap.
How about Scorsese?
From Snap, Crackle and Pop on the Rice Krispies base.
Is that right?
So I look like Snap.
He says you look like Snap. Where did that come from?
Rice Krispies box.
Well, yeah, but where did that, what project was that on?
There's no project.
Just working together, yeah.
They live together, too.
We used to live together years ago, yeah.
No kidding.
Before he got started, yeah.
He'll still take your calls?
Oh, yeah.
Harry Dean Stanton, actor in more than 180 films. Sophie Uber, director of the new documentary, Harry Dean Stanton, Partly Fiction, which opens today in New York.
Today in New York and on Friday in L.A. and on the 27th nationwide.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So here's a milestone. In 1960, there were just 3 billion people living on Earth. By 2011, the world population surpassed 7 billion. By 2100, the United Nations estimates that the world population could reach almost 11 billion. How to understand just what that means? Stephen Emmett has taken on that project with an interesting new book that is part PowerPoint presentation, part data visualization exercise, and part news headline. Emmett is head of Microsoft Research's Computational Science Laboratory in Cambridge, England. The book is called simply 10 Billion. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you really have a task here to describe something that we all understand. The climate is changing. The population is rising precipitously. But in some ways, the design of this book is trying to get at how people can really understand what that means. What did you set out to accomplish here?
Well, you're correct in as much as the design or the flavor of the book in how it's written is designed to be as accessible as possible to as many people as possible. It's certainly not aimed at scientists. It's even I would go as far as to say it's even aimed at people who wouldn't ordinarily read books. And I think it's because I wanted to try and get as many people as possible to think about the challenges that we face in ways that we're simply not thinking about them at the moment. You outlined a few. That said, I'm not sure that I would go as far as to say the book is part PowerPoint and part.
I say PowerPoint just because there are simple phrases on each page, you know, almost captions, and then lots of graphs,
right,
and then lots of extraordinary aerial shots which show, for instance, the scale of industrial agriculture,
yes,
which was responsible for growth of the population,
right,
at certain levels. I mean, you really sort of tell the story very, very well, but it really – it seems to me that the book is forcing you to visualize what's going on with the Earth as much as it is giving you some sort of analytical scientific explanation.
That's right. I mean I think we need to be careful saying that there's no analysis. Behind the book, there's a lot of analysis. But in each, you know, as you point out, I cover a range of topics ranging from agriculture, water, energy, climate, land use, consumption, economics, politics. And it would have been very easy to have written a 400-something page book on each one of those issues. But no one's going to read such a book, right? If you stitch it together. It'd be like, you know, some sort of 5,000-page tome. And so the trick was, and it's not clear to me whether, I suppose time will tell whether I've in any sense accomplished it, to try and convey the breadth of issues that we face in a way that, as I say, will reach as many people as possible.
Do you have to convince people for this book to be successful? It's not enough that simply people who already know this are intrigued and get to reiterate something they already believe.
No, it's not about trying to convince people. It's just trying to set out the issues and people can take it, you know, or take it for what it's worth. It's interesting you may say convince people, because I think one of the reasons why pressure groups and green groups are failing in their efforts in these areas is it's all around trying to convince individuals of something. Mm. And I think that, you know, we're well beyond that time, actually, I think.
As I was reading and looking at the graphs, I was trying to think, what if you were writing a book for ants describing their explosive population growth and the various stages of the development that, you know, ants went from, you know, a billion to a trillion to however many quadrillion ants there are on the planet. In a sense, there's an assumption in this book that humans had some kind of control over restraining their demands for first food and then energy and now industrial consumption, when in fact, as you get into this book, you feel much more like we're powerless. We're just sort of a victim of our own desires, like the ants or like any other population species on Earth that just grows continuously.
Well, actually, on the contrary, I think instead of being powerless, we are deliberately driving the problems that we face. It's just that we seem not to care about them. I mean, we seem to have collectively decided to yawn about, for example, climate, and because we're simply not doing anything about it. But it doesn't mean to say we couldn't. We know that some of the problems that are related to that, like the fact that we're going to have to double agricultural production by 2050, okay, that might be something not as many people know about as, for example, the climate. But how we're going to do that is anything but clear. Of course, advocates of this continuing, never-ending green revolution say, well, we've done it since the 1960s, we'll just carry on. And that kind of simple extrapolation is, in my view, not warranted.
Well, the graphs certainly give you a sense that there's got to be an upper limit somewhere, that we're going to smash against the ceiling here. But I'm wondering, when the decision – I mean, there was no decision taken, or at least you wouldn't have stopped to think – wow, we could grow 10 times as much food, you know, 100 years ago when that became the case and industrial agriculture happened.
Right.
Of course you'd want to do something like that. It's only now that you get to the point where you say, maybe we don't want to do X, Y, or Z, and we don't really have that skill.
No. I'm not sure that we don't have the skill to stop, it seems.
Yeah.
And nor do we have the skill to continue. We don't have the technology to continue, in my view, on the trajectory that we're currently on.
So will we get to 10 billion, or will something happen that basically – because if you look at the graph of population, there are some downturns, you know, in the medieval period, plagues, that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, it is possible that, for example, a new global pandemic could wipe out, you know, it might be a billion, certainly wouldn't be all 10 billion. But that's a bit of an unknown. I mean, it is true that increasingly epidemiologists say it's when, not if. It could be in 2200, it could be next week. But I think barring something like that, we can be fairly safe that we're going to reach at least 10 billion. I should say that as of today, we're on what's called what the UN calls the constant fertility variant or fertility rate of birth rate per woman. And if that were to continue, and even I don't think this would happen, there would be 28 billion of us by the end of the century.
Well, if the pandemic population decline does happen next week, please come back.
I will.
Stephen Emmett is head of Microsoft Research's Computational Science Laboratory in Cambridge, England, professor of computational science at the University of Oxford. His new book is called 10 Billion. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, we're talking about the survival of AM radio. Can it survive? Is it doomed to the same technology limbo and interference that house fax machines, dial-up modems, and bikes with a huge front wheel? At least some of you still feel the love.
Hi, this is Donna calling from Seattle. I'm going to take you way back with AM radio. I remember sitting at the top of the stairs and sneaking a listen to The Shadow and Inner Sanctum and the Jack Benny Show when I was a very small child while my parents were listening to the radio downstairs.
The Jell-O program starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston and Phil Harris and his orchestra.
One of my favorite memories of AM radio was when I was in the third grade and my father helped me construct a crystal radio. Late at night, was listening to boxing matches of Rocky Marciano. That's a really special memory to me.
And this crowd has gone absolutely wild. 8, 9, Walcott hasn't moved. It's all over! All over! Winner and new heavyweight champion of the world, Rocky Marciano.
It's not interference, that AM signal and your memories of it. Keep them coming. We love the stories. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or post a picture of your AM radio at facebook.com/The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.